Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Just over 1.5 million students will graduate from college this year. So is it possible for a commencement address to resonate with the endless waves of 20-somethings in their caps and gowns? Here with us in Studio 3 to look at the anatomy of the graduation speech is Nancy Kane. Nancy's an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hello there, Nancy.
Hey there.
Hello, Nancy. Good to see you. So, you think that you have found a fantastic commencement speech?
I'm not alone in this assessment. So, my favorite commencement speech, and I, you know, have looked at some from the earlier 20th century as well as more recent ones, is David Foster Wallace's address in the summer or the late spring of 2007 before Kenyon College in Ohio. It has a big, big internet following, and it is. And for all of our listeners that want to read it, it bears not only listening. You can listen to it or watch it on YouTube because he was filmed giving it, and you can read it in transcription. It goes by the title "This Is Water." It was titled officially the 2007 commencement speech, but it's become known as the "This Is Water" speech. And there's even, believe it or not, this is how popular it is, a short, action movie of it. So you can see that as well. With fish, complete with fish, because this is water obtained to the opening paragraph about fish swimming around. And this astounding kind of crystallizing scene that he describes in the middle of the speech about the boredom and tedium and self-centeredness of adult life.
You teach this, do you not?
I teach a big hunk of this. Actually, I teach several hunks of it, but particularly the part of the end of the speech to executives. He talks a lot in the speech about our default settings, because the premise of the address, and this is what's so interesting, is that he says, yeah, and he's very, very careful to kind of upend every single cliche about commencement speeches, to call them out and then try and turn them on their head. He says, you know, every single commencement speech talks about how you've come to college to learn how to think. And he says, yes, that sounds condescending. Yes, it's a cliche. But there's something incredibly truthful about it. And it's less about how you think than that that you have the choice about what to think. And so the whole speech is about how we frame things, you know, how we look at different moments in our life. And he just kind of takes that covering a strawberry with chocolate, layer after layer after layer of meaning around how we choose to see ourselves and where we are in a certain moment and how that changes everything.
Now, in a second, we're going to play a little piece of what Foster Wallace did out there. So you get a sense, you can hear his voice and I think be more a part of this. But before we do, tell the fish piece from the opening paragraph, just so people understand how he set this thing up.
So the opening is about is two young fish. He's describing this, two young fish swimming along, and they happen to meet an older fish who says, "Morning, boys, how's the water?" And the two young fish swim on for a little bit, and then eventually, and now I'm reading this, one of them looks over at the other and goes, "What the hell is water?"
And his point is what?
His point is that, you know, that we are so conditioned to falling into our default settings, ways of viewing, you know, a line in the grocery store, ways of viewing the fact that the Starbucks coffee we just got wasn't made the right way, ways of viewing, you know, a particular piece of news we just got at the office, that we forget that what's actually really happening. Now, that's the only way we can see what's really happening right now. We're not paying attention to anything else other than the reaction we've just had to a particular event or happenstance. And so we forget that this is water. What the hell is water? My Starbucks coffee didn't taste very good. And so it's a fascinating. I mean, I said to one of my to a group of executives I was coaching, I think this is one of the most profound pieces of prose I have ever read. And I include, remember, I love Lincoln and Shakespeare, so I'm putting Wallace in good company here, because of the astounding simplicity and at the same time the astounding difficulty of what he is saying about the choice we have moment by moment to think, stay present, and try and summon up empathy for ourselves and others so that we're not just defaulting into what is my experience right now at the center of my skull-sized kingdom.
Here is a little bit of David Foster Wallace, just to give you a taste of what he was like that day.
Look, the insidious thing about these forms of worship is not that they're evil or sinful. It is that they are unconscious. They are default settings. They're the kind of worship you just gradually slip into day after day, getting more and more selective about what you see and how you measure value without ever being fully aware that that's what you're doing. And the so-called real world will not discourage you from operating on your default settings, because the so-called real world of men and money and power hums merrily along on the fuel of fear and anger and frustration and craving and the worship of self. Our own present culture has harnessed these forces in ways that have yielded extraordinary wealth and comfort and personal freedom. The freedom all to be lords of our own tiny skull-sized kingdoms, alone at the center of all creation.
Okay, Nancy, what'd you make of that section of the speech?
So I think this is part of a piece that I use in.
Nancy has a knowing smile on her face, by the way, I should say, as she's speaking.
Well,
go ahead.
I just love this piece. This is in some sense just past the denouement of the speech, the inflection point of, you know, what's the point in really concentrating on how we're thinking about things, and if you will, walking around the statue. I like to talk to executives about, if this moment or this event or this person or this problem or this fire you're trying to put out, think of it as Michelangelo's statue in the Academia of David, the David statue.
Yes.
And you can still, day of vandalism of artworks, you can walk around it, and it looks very different whether you're looking at the back of David or the side of David or the front of David or just, you know, kind of at 11 o'clock on David. And so what Wallace is saying is we can look at a given moment or ourselves or this event in a lot of different ways. And we can choose, literally, where around the statue we stand and look. And that's incredibly powerful. And so when he says, look, the insidious things about all these worship is not that they're evil. And he's talking about worship of power, worship of money, worship of beauty, worship of fame. The things that we tend to live in a society in which collectively we value those things and put them high on our list of what we should be or want to be or should have. He's saying, look, the problem is that that's unconscious. We never stop to look at whether that is really the whole story, or even the most important story, or even the story we want to write about our lives. And he goes on in the next paragraph or two. I really recommend, good listeners, do not pass go, do not collect $200, go read the speech, especially the last half. He's saying, look, you know, our world won't discourage you from looking at those, from getting out of those default settings, but if you do, you're going to discover not only something more interesting, something more true, something more connected, something more, you know, more enriching and freeing, you are going to discover, you know, the essence of what constitutes the good life. And it's an essence that's not a holy grail. It's not something you get like Rocky in the first, you know, movie, running up the Philadelphia Art Museum steps when he's in shape and like shaking his arms and after he's drunk the raw eggs. It's not like that at all. It's an accretive set of choices we make every single day to not operate solely on default settings, but to operate from a perspective of what we are, how we are connected to each other, and how we are connected to something other than worship of money, worship of self, worship of power.
Well, you know, when he says in here too, if you worship power, you'll end up feeling weak and afraid, and you'll need even more power. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart, you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out. Same thing about worshiping, you know, your old beauty and sexual allure. You're eventually going to be old and decrepit. And you know what else I found in here? There's a lot of Buddhism in here. I don't know if he was a Buddhist in his real life, but the whole idea in Buddhism of people are not the enemy and have compassion for people instead of viewing the person in the checkout line as your enemy because they're in front of you with an extra item in the checkout, which we all do.
We all do that.
We all do. I just found it unbelievably wise for a man that was not that old. I mean,
he's so wise. I was driving over here thinking, my God, you know, he finishes this piece, you know, maybe finishes the night before, maybe finishes 3 weeks before. This is so well written. He's thought about it so carefully. It sounds impromptu, but there's nothing impromptu about this. It's like Lincoln, right? He's really run this through the wire mesh of good writing. And I thought, how proud at some level he must have been to, you know, kind of print out the pages and carry them up to the podium because it is so wise. And yet, you know, it took him a while to peel back the layers of this onion to get here, because most of his writing is not leading to this. He wrote widely. He wrote on varied subjects. He wrote fiction. He wrote prose. He did journalism. This is its own genre and its own gospel, and it is very, very powerful.
And by the way, the horrible end of the story is not that long after this. He took his own life, right? How long after this was
it? So he gave this speech in the spring of 2005, and he hung himself in his home in California in early September 2007. Mm-hmm. He had battled, as his parents later said publicly, with very serious depression for more than 20 years. So I believe he was something like 46 when he died. So he's a relatively young man who had spent his adult life dealing with depression.
So when you're teaching this, or when you're executive coaching, what's the takeaway? Other than how brilliant itself is, what's the transferable thing?
Here's the takeaway. The takeaway is at the end of this you know, kind of set of paragraphs that our listeners just heard, where he says, look, there are lots of kinds of freedom, but the freedom that you won't heard much talked about in the great outside world of winning, displaying, you know, and succeeding, is the freedom to care about others in a myriad of sexy, petty ways over and over every day. That is real freedom. That is not operating on your default settings. That, right, is this sense of having access to some infinite thing. And the reason I end a lot of my work, especially if I've done multi-sessions, you know, it's a week and we've had four or five sessions together, I end this, you know, our work together with a group of, say, 40, 50 high-powered executives on this note is because of this. I have learned over the last 25 years or more of studying leaders, by past and present, that the most effective leadership, when you're really trying to move the mountain in toward a worthy place, is all about the ability of the leader to literally connect in petty, unsexy ways with all the different people all the way down the chain or across the chain of stakeholders that have to help move them out in petty, unsexy ways. So great leadership actually begins with getting out of the default settings of, oh my God, we're going to get this kind of, you know, bottom line or this kind of earnings per share this week or we're going to crumble. It begins with, here's who I am and why I think we should head for Damascus this way, and why you and my, in you know, the internal connection I have to you, the any person that I'm talking to or leading, why that connection is going to help us get to Damascus. So you got to get rid of the default settings, or at least you got to let them loose and operate in a broader frame to lead toward any kind of successful impact. And I want to remind lots of alpha males and alpha females, silverback gorillas, that it's not just the default settings.
That's Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School. Nancy, can we talk about a couple of other memorable ones make most people's – well, one makes the top 10 list. Somebody we've talked to you a lot about in 2005, same year as this one, Steve Jobs gives a commencement speech at Stanford. And what I've read about it this morning are two things. One, the great little anecdote, which I love, is he hired a speechwriter, and the speechwriter, he stood him up. And
stood up Steve Jobs. So he sat at his kitchen table, you know, in Palo Alto and wrote the speech. And it's a great speech.
And that's the second thing people say about it. It's the most self-revelatory thing people say that Jobs has ever spoken or written. What was the essence of his thing?
So the essence of the speech is very short. You can watch him deliver it in beard and pink gown or maroon gown for Stanford colors on YouTube.
Marjorie's alma mater,
that's right.
And mine as well.
Really?
Yeah. And he tells three different stories. He tells the story of going to Reed College and dropping out and what he learned after he dropped out. He tells the story of getting cancer and basically live each day like it's your last. Those are the first and the third stories. And the middle story is about getting kicked out of Apple in the mid-80s when John Sculley, the former CEO of Pepsi, came in and took over. Like, he wanted an adult at the wheel, and he got kicked out, and how disappointed he was and how hurt, and yet how all of these different pieces, right, the dropping out of Reed College and the calligraphy he learned that then comes to influence the typography of the Mac, what he learned after getting kicked out at Apple at Next and Pixar, and how that comes to affect what will become the next round when he comes back to Apple in the late 1990s, the next round of computers, and then the the iPhone and the iPad, and I'm just forgetting the iPod. iPod. Thank you. Oh my God. Because the iPhone is the iPod and the iPod. And then and then the last piece is about his first bout with pancreatic cancer and what it felt like when the doctors thought he was going to die in 90 days. He would later go on to have at least like six more years. And how that changed him. And so the point of the speech is these three morals: live like tomorrow's your last, connect the dots. Right, you drop out of Reed College, but guess what? Everything you do there still ends up mattering. And sometimes failure, as Oprah Winfrey said in last year's Harvard commencement, is sometimes failure is just another way of the universe turning you in a new direction. Right, because leaving Apple in the mid '80s actually turned out to be really great for Apple and Steve Jobs in 1997 when he came back. And the last piece of the story of the address, which is really probably the most quoted part of the address, besides connect the dots in your life, consciously choose to connect the dots, is this. And it comes from the Whole Earth Catalog, which some of our listeners will remember.
Oh, yes.
From the 1960s Stuart Brand's book. It is stay hungry, stay foolish. And
yeah.
So it's, you know, it's delivered in a terribly humane, uncharacteristically humane and humble way. It has this huge cult-like following because I think a lot of people want to believe that Steve Jobs was probably not as much of a jerk as he certainly was at times. And he's not a jerk at all in this speech. And it's a wonderful commencement speech told from the heart. So that is a great speech. And it's short.
When does Harvard graduate? June's? What?
They're graduating this week.
This week,
Harvard's
okay.
graduating this week.
Michael Bloomberg
is the commencement speaker. And just a plug for the Harvard Business School, Saul Khan is going to deliver our class day speech, which I think is fabulous.
Wow. Fantastic. He's the guy
from
that
the
does all the online.
Khan Academy,
Khan.
Yep.
Yes. So tell us a little bit about Jill Abrams. We're going to play a piece of her before we get to her. But to put this in context, she had just been canned at the New York Times. Could have canceled this speech at Wake Forest. But
didn't she cancel a Brandeis or something, Margaret?
I don't know.
I think she canceled a local speech and then did Wake Forest. Anyway.
I don't know, but let's hear a little bit of Jill Abramson, who, of course, was the executive editor of the New York Times, speaking at Wake Forest just a couple of days after she did get canned.
What's next for me? I don't know. So I'm in exactly the same boat as many of you.
Now, I love this speech. Other people disagree with me, but I thought it showed an incredible sense of humor and resilience, which was her theme, days after losing the job that she loved.
I agree. I didn't hear it. That's the first I've heard her voice, but I read it. And it's interesting because it's really, so far, her only public comment in any way on what happened at the Times, which I gather was relatively unexpected. Right?
Totally,
it was not a long fuse here that's, you know, that I think she and lots of other people in the newsroom had any idea was coming. So I thought it showed not only resilience, I think that's a really important word here and a really important word for our moment in history, for young and older Americans, but also a kind of grace under pressure, if you will.
Yes.
So what she didn't do is jump into the fray and start sort of, you know, slinging arrows of outrageous fortune and infamy at her former employers at the time. She did none of that. She said really basically nothing until she went to Wake Forest and could not only kind of take the mickey of herself, right, make, you know, sort of laugh at herself, but do it with grace and an old-fashioned word, a kind of aplomb, right, a kind of calm, dignity, and composure. And some humor, and I give her lots of credit
that,
right? To walk in there with her head tall, and she said, by the way, in the speech, for those of our listeners that haven't heard it, she said, I'm going to stay in journalism. It's what I love. I want to get the story. I don't know exactly how that's going to play out. I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't have another job, but I'm going to stay in the game, which reminded me of another great commencement speech, which you can read online, by Winston Churchill in 1944 at the Harrow School, private school in England, secondary school, where this is 1944, so the war's not over, right? D-Day has not happened, and he's never give in, back to resilience and persistence. Another great speech by a great speechwriter, short, to the point, but full of, you know, if you will, you know, tools for our tool belt that we want to wear for our lives.
What's your take on the controversy of the season and past seasons? Condoleezza Rice, being essentially asked not to do her thing at Rutgers, Lagarde not the head of the IMF being asked not to do her thing at Smith. You know, there's this whole controversy about freedom of speech. And I have to say, my attitude about this is, if you're having someone to speak on campus, then anybody and everybody who's got credentials should be able to speak. And obviously, you respond to that. But this whole notion that students are being reviled, the former head of Princeton is trashing students somewhere the other day for having caused, who I can't remember who it is, whoever the speaker was, to back out. This is the day for the students, it seems to me. It's not this whole notion that anybody with any worldview should be able to speak. I have to say, I'm not with on that particular day.
I mean, I think we're making a great mountain out of a small molehill, a hillock, as we'd say in England here. The First Amendment guarantees freedom of speech. That's not just freedom for Christine Lagarde to talk about IMF policies when it was mostly faculty that turned the corner at Smith, as I read the news reports.
It wasn't at Rutgers with Rice, though. It was faculty and students.
Well, because students were involved in Smith,
war,
too. Yeah. But what sounds like the petition that kind of shifted the equation for the publicity people at the IMF and Lagarde was a petition by 120 faculty members. So freedom of speech exists everywhere. Lagarde is free to say what she will about IMF development programs or IMF security programs.
But it doesn't give her a right to speak anywhere she wants,
No, but she's free to say that at Smith if she comes invited and actually comes.
Of course.
And students and faculty are free to protest that. So if in the end, the different freedoms, end up with Lagarde saying, her people saying, this is not good policy for us to go in this kind of environment, and the folks at Rutgers say students are too upset, so sorry, Condoleezza, or sorry, Ms. Rice, then I don't see that there's anything kind of condemning on either side about this. This is how it played out. In general, who decides what who the commencement speaker will be varies institution by institution. So in lots of institutions, students vote on the commencement speaker, right? And then that subject,
I'm all for that.
But in others, administrations choose. So so I think we don't really have a grand kind of postulate
But I guess my question is, if students protest and as a result a speaker pulls out, what's the harm? They exercise their right and the speaker chose not to be there.
You know what the harm is to me in some of these situations is that the students do things that are really stupid. And I remember when Barbara Bush came to speak at Wellesley College, and she was it wasn't about her being the wife of Republican George Bush. It was about her having dropped out of college to become a mother. And Wellesley was all up in arms. This wasn't a great example. And it's true, a lot of women are at Wellesley not to drop out of school.
What, that she chose motherhood? You mean?
Yes. And she came, and she was great. And I thought there's a small-mindedness among some of these kids that kind of bothers me, because it's not a grand view.
So let's go back to David Foster Wallace or J.R. Rowling, who was the commencement speaker several years ago at Harvard, and I think has wrote a brilliant commencement speech. You can Google that, short and very powerful. And she has two kind of stories to tell. One of them is about failure. That's very popular on the commencement circuit. But the other one is about a lack of imagination. And she and Wallace are saying exactly what you're saying, Marjorie. They're saying, come on, let's cultivate some open-mindedness. Let's walk around to the back of the statue. So, just because Barbara Bush didn't choose a paying career, she certainly chose to work if she was a mother, God, doesn't
of
mean
many
she,
children.
And just because Christine Lagarde, is in charge of a large NGO in which she's trying to actually turn that battleship, doesn't mean she has something, doesn't have anything worthy to offer to those graduates. So it is about open-mindedness, and it is about Wallace. We default too quickly to our settings.
Very good.
One woman who never defaults to her settings, Nancy Kane. Great to see you. Thanks,
okay.
Nancy.
A pleasure.
It is so much fun to talk to you. Nancy Kane joins us every Tuesday. We're so happy you do for Open Mic. She's an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Up next, we're going to look at the Jared Remy case again and ask you whether the sins of the son should be visited on the father, whether Jared Remy's history and now his guilty plea should be held against his father, former Red Sox player and now Red Sox broadcaster, Jerry Remy. That discussion next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.